Hi everyone. I hope you've all been well since we last spoke. Welcome to this, the April edition of the Economic History Podcast. And today I spoke with Professor Eric Schneider of the London School of Economics. Eric's work primarily concerns the areas of the history of health and historical economic demography. And today Eric takes us through some of his papers that he's published over the previous years. We look at his work in the Economic History Review, published in 2021, and that was called The Growth Pattern of British Children, 1850 to 1975. That's co-authored with Pei Gao. We also look towards the end at Eric's work, Children's Growth in an Adaptive Framework, explaining the growth patterns of American slaves and other historical populations. That was in the Economic History Review again, and that was 2017. And during our discussion, we dip in and out of Eric's survey article that was in the Journal of Economic Surveys, published in 2023, which is sort of Eric's summary of the findings in the literature and some of his own insights. And that was called The Determinants of Child Stunting and Shifts in the Growth Pattern of Children, a Long-Run Global View. I really enjoyed this chat. I knew very little about it before I dived into it, and Eric was very generous with his time. So I now hand you over until next time to my conversation with Professor Eric Schneider. Professor Eric Schneider, thank you very much for joining us on the Economic History Podcast. I'll start off by asking the usual question. How did you get into economic history in the first place?
Well, it's a great question, and thanks so much for having me, Sean. My path to economic history actually came from being quite undecided as an undergrad of what I wanted to study. So I came to university, and in the first semester I took a history class and a biology class, and that actually, those were the two paths that I was considering after the first semester. But in the end, I ended up gravitating more toward history than biology. And I think the reason is that, like, for me, history is the only kind of truly interdisciplinary discipline. And that's because in order to understand the past, we need all the tools that we need to understand today, plus, you know, the historical skills that you need as well. And so I felt like this could allow me to explore, you know, my innate interests in the most, you know, free way if I stayed with history. And I was just fascinated by it and really passionate about it.
And when you started out, Eric, or even lately, was there any book or paper or papers that really inspired you along the way?
There are so many papers that I could mention in books that have influenced me. But I think, you know, the one that really comes to mind is a paper by Sarah Horrell, David Meredith, and Deborah Oxley called Measuring Misery. And it's really interesting in many ways. But what it does basically is it looks at prisoners in the Wandsworth House of Correction in London in the Victorian period. And it looks at their BMIs of the prisoners. And so it finds that, like, men had higher BMIs, especially older men, than older women. But I think the most interesting and, like, intriguing thing for me that's inspired me again and again was the fact that they were able to track the prisoners' weights during their time in prison. And so they found that men lost weight in prison and women gained weight. And this is on a very nasty prison ration, right? Not kind of pleasant food. And so they were able to kind of infer from that the rations that the women were getting in prison were better than what they were eating, you know, outside of prison, whereas they were much worse for the men. And there's a selection, they are very careful, right? So that they deal with a lot of the kind of maybe the issues that might come to mind when I tell this story. But I think it's that kind of careful data work that really inspired me with that paper. I think also, our field is moving so much toward big data. And, like, I am on board with that and moving toward that in future work as well. But I think what one of the really cool things that paper shows is that you can answer really interesting questions, even with, like, relatively smaller data. I mean, they still have thousands of observations, obviously. But, with a kind of precisely kind of posed question, you can really do a lot with a kind of relatively, say, limited data set, compared to what people are using today.
And was there a moment for you that you knew when this career path was something you were interested in?
I think the moment for me was that actually came in my master's program when I was researching in Oxford. And I remember one day kind of being in the library until like, you know, relatively late, say, you know, 8:30, 9 p.m., something like that. Been in the science library in Oxford, reading about the biology of human growth. And I hadn't really made any particular epiphany. I hadn't really discovered something new or, you know, anything like that. But I remember leaving the library at about, you know, 9 o'clock, going to meet someone to have a pint. And it was just a beautiful twilight. And I thought, wow, this is a really nice life. I could do this.
And you've talked about the changes in our field in the last while. Are there any tips or pieces of advice that you would give to younger scholars coming through now or new scholars to the field?
This is always difficult, right? And I think the thing that would be most important that I would say is to really be wary of people who seem like they always know the answer. You know, like nobody is kind of omniscient in this field. Nobody can tell you exactly what the right advice is for you. And I feel like some people are trying to find certainty in places where there isn't certainty. And, you know, it's better, I think, both for mentors and for people who are seeking advice to keep that in mind. I think the other thing that has been quite important to me is like interdisciplinarity. And that, I think, means a couple of things. Like one is just reading outside of economic history and economics, trying to take in the insights of other disciplines. But I think also it's about trying to like put yourself in the position of somebody approaching a question from a different discipline. So rather than just taking your economist toolkit and just applying it everywhere, right? You actually think about, well, why would a historian or why would a demographer or why would a evolutionary biologist think about this question in a different way? And what can I learn from thinking about it in the way that they think about it that might affect, you know, my own research or how I approach the question? And so I think that's been really useful to me. And then finally, I guess, this might be something I would have said to myself at, you know, earlier in my career, which is that like, it's easy, you know, especially as a kind of more junior scholar to get caught up in the game, right? Like there's a game of academia. How is it that you publish? How do you, you know, succeed in that sense? And the game is important. I don't mean to say that, but it's like the point of academia isn't the game, right? That's just what we have to do, right? The point of academia and being an economic historian is producing knowledge, discovering new things about the past. And that's what gives meaning to the research that we do, not where it's published or, you know, things like that. So those would be some things to think about.
We're going to turn now to your own work, Eric. And a lot of it has to do with the type of data you were talking about, biological data, particularly heights. Can you explain why you're interested in heights as a theme or as a measure, and why you think the study of heights and use of height data is important or useful in economic history?
Yeah, I think there's kind of like a personal and professional side to why I'm interested in heights. You know, some of this, yeah, comes from my own biology. So I'm an identical twin. You know, my brother was actually larger than me at birth. And I had some kind of health challenges at birth. You know, I came out first. And so there were, you know, there's issues there. And I was very sick as a young child for a short period of time after birth. But then, you know, both of us were actually allergic to milk as young children, but I outgrew the milk allergy and my brother didn't. And I'm about an inch and a half taller than him today as an adult. And so I think, you know, like some of this is related to my own kind of experience of height and, you know, and seeing that. I also remember my dad talking to me about how he was taller than my grandfather and that I would probably be taller than him, which is true. So, you know, there's a kind of personal link to this. But I think also from a professional standpoint, you know, I had this background and interest in biology. And so, you know, studying height was a really interesting way of combining my interest in biology with what I was interested in history and in economics as well. So heights are a really important measure of welfare, in part because welfare is multidimensional. And so from my perspective on that, you know, it's not like we should be trying to find the best indicator, right? Or like, you know, wages are better than height, or like this, that's not really the right way forward here. But we have a kind of a range of options for how we're going to measure it, welfare. And height captures things that, you know, other indicators don't, right? So it can capture nutrition in a kind of very robust quantitative way. It captures child morbidity. So like the sickness that children experience, as, you know, because that can affect their height, you know, and that sickness may not actually reflect the mortality statistics that we see for child mortality, because things that kill you are not necessarily the things that make you sick. And I think, you know, another thing it captures that's really fascinating is allocation of resources within households. You know, if we see the wages of a household head, we don't know how that food is being allocated among the children. But, you know, really interesting height studies have looked at that problem. So, and I guess like for me, like how I was trying to kind of change or shift that literature was, a lot of it in the past had focused really on adult height. And I'm certainly not the first person to look at child growth either, so I don't want to say that, but I was really particularly interested in understanding the process of growth. And I think that's kind of a different focus from, you know, at least the kind of main thrust of the height literature before I got to it.
For those of us who aren't kind of used to dealing with heights, can you sort of lay out the general growth pattern for novices in the subject?
Sure. It's interesting to explain this on a podcast, because normally I do this with graphs and, you know, I have kind of very specific way of doing this visually, but I'll give it a go. So I think there are kind of four really important aspects of the growth pattern, and then some ways that we can see, you know, what's going on with these characteristics. So the first is adult size, which is just height, the adult height that has been studied for so many years. Kind of related to that is birth size, which isn't exactly the same, but yeah, we can talk about why in a minute, but that's the second characteristic. The third characteristic is the timing of the pubertal growth spurt. So this is the age at which children reach their kind of maximum growth during adolescence. You know, I think all of us probably remember having this pubertal growth spurt. So it's a kind of feature of modern growth, at least. And then finally, there's the speed of maturation. So this is how quickly children develop, right? Do they grow really rapidly and then stop growing at, say, 17, as we do today, or at least some people do today? Or as in the past, do people grow maybe into their early 20s? You know, so they're kind of spreading out the growth over a longer period of time. So there are kind of two things to add on to those four characteristics. The first is what's called growth faltering. So what we observe in kind of unhealthy populations is that children grow too slowly, especially in the first 1,000 days. So the first 1,000 days is like conception to age 2. So they grow too slowly in that period, which means they kind of fall behind healthy children. And this kind of pattern of growth faltering is very common around the world. And the way we tend to try to measure that is with child stunting. And child stunting is just the share of children who are too short for their age relative to our kind of standards of healthy children. And so that's capturing a couple of things. It's capturing birth size, because if you start out kind of low, you're going to be kind of stunted. And also this growth faltering. So if you grow too slowly in the first 1,000 days, you'll become progressively farther behind the kind of healthy children. And then we also see that stunting has impacts on adult heights as well. So it's kind of affecting those three parts of the growth pattern.
And you have documented and studied changes to these growth patterns through time in a recent survey of the literature and your own literature. Can you list the main findings and what you see as the determinants of these changes?
Yeah, sure. So I'll start with adult heights, because that's the kind of thing that has been studied most and that we know the most about, because the data is most prevalent. So there's been a secular increase in adult stature that's occurred in almost every single country. The magnitude really varies quite a bit. Secular increase just means that mean heights have gotten bigger. So for instance, British men are 11 centimeters taller than they were in the late 19th century today. But it can be a lot bigger than that. So a recent kind of study that tried to map this across the entire world found that women in South Korea are 20 centimeters taller than they were in the late 19th century. And men in Iran are 16. So those are the kind of max, you know, the highest growth that we've seen. And the really interesting thing about that, right, is that this isn't about any kind of evolution, right? It's not that, you know, individual genes are changing or there's some kind of sexual selection that's leading to an increase in height. There have been people who've looked at this very carefully and done, yeah, simulations. And, you know, in order to get the secular increase in heights in the Netherlands, you would need, for instance, only the top or the tallest third of the population to reproduce over time, which obviously doesn't match the empirical reality at all. This is mainly driven by changes in the environment. So things that like changes in nutrition, in child morbidity that are affecting children's growth. So that's how that first characteristic of the growth pattern has changed. Moving to the second one, which is birth size. I think the easiest way to capture that is birth weight, because it's easier to measure than length. Try measuring a squirming baby, right? Their weight is much easier to capture. And here we have some pretty surprising findings, things that actually I found very surprising when I first learned about them. And that's that actually, if we compare birth weights, birth weight distributions and the means of birth weights in Western Europe, North America, Australia, and New Zealand between the late 19th century and today, we see very little change. There is a little bit of change, maybe like, you know, 60 gram increase and then a little decrease in the United States. But that's really small compared to the changes in adult stature that we see. So actually, there's not a lot of change in birth size in those types of countries. On the other hand, we see in low and middle income countries that the mean birth weight is much, much lower. So if the average in kind of these Western countries is about 3,400 grams, it can be as low as 2,700 grams or 2,800 grams in India or other countries like that. And we also see really big changes over time if we think of the case of Japan. So between the early 20th century and 1970, Japan experienced a 250 gram increase in birth weight, which is really big, really, really big. So that's an interesting kind of difference between different parts of the world that we see. When it comes to the timing of the pubertal growth spurt, it's shifted to earlier ages over time. So, and it can be as much as 2 years earlier than it was, say, 100 years ago. So that's changing. And we also see a kind of speeding up of maturation. So children are reaching their final adult height earlier than they used to. So this kind of increased adult stature is not just about kind of people growing faster or like just shifting the kind of velocity curve of growth upward. It's also about kind of condensing the time in which that growth occurs, which means that the velocities are even faster than they would otherwise be. And if we link this then to child stunting, so in a kind of recent or, well, ongoing work, hopefully soon to be out the door, I've worked with about 40 co-authors to reconstruct child stunting rates all around the world, going back as far as possible. And we find that there have been really big declines in child stunting, even in high-income countries today. And so if Japan actually, I'll talk a lot about Japan probably because Japan is the best data that we have. But in Japan, the stunting rate was over 70% in 1900, which is similar to what India, the kind of level in India in the early 1990s. And now Japan has completely eradicated stunting. So it's down to kind of normal levels. So there's been really, really big changes. If we think about Europe, the stunting rate in Britain was 40-45% in around 1900 and has declined kind of in the interwar period. So that's actually higher or around, yeah, I think it is higher than India today, right? So we've seen big, big changes in these indicators over time that reflect this kind of general change in the growth pattern.
These are phenomenal changes, Eric. Why?
That's the question, right? It's a really open question, right? You know, there have been changes in nutrition and improvements in nutrition that seem to have mattered. But my reading of the literature is that those don't kind of fundamentally explain the differences that we're seeing here. I'm, more sympathetic to ideas about child morbidity, so especially diarrheal diseases that prevent children from absorbing the nutrients that they're eating, that they might have a really strong impact, and therefore, but in my future work, I'm also starting to think a little bit more about pollution, right, and how that would affect chronic respiratory diseases for children. And how that might, again, tax their resources and prevent them from growing in a healthy way. In the review article, I go through and talk about, I think, eight different potential reasons for this. And unfortunately, there's not kind of like a smoking gun, right? There's not one indicator that, or one kind of cause that explains these changes that we see. It's likely to be a kind of amalgamation of a number of different things.
The thing that would come to mind is a lot of these countries have grown in their income, but you're talking about countries that have not grown all that much with income as well. They're included in this sample as well. So it's something else that's driving this.
Yeah, income, you would think income, right? But there's a kind of study using kind of recent evidence on child stunting that shows that income growth actually is just the coefficient is zero, right? On income growth does not affect stunting, basically. You see this if you look at the time trends of individual countries. There are some countries that have experienced, they experience what you would expect. Income has gone up and stunting has gone down, and it kind of looks like a kind of nice pattern. But then you see other countries that follow kind of a vertical path where it's like the stunting rate just falls, even though their income doesn't change at all, right? And others are very flat, like Equatorial Guinea is kind of the case in point for this. It's a country that experienced a huge amount of wealth, or its wealth has increased a lot because of an oil boom. And the stunting rate has been basically flat, right? Because this wealth isn't shared equally across the population. So it's not as simple as income, at least GDP growth. I think it gets to be maybe a little bit easier when you're thinking about individuals' income, right? But we don't have like a lot of data that would allow us to test that. In kind of modern data where people look at that, individual like household wealth does seem to matter quite a bit.
Sort of chimes with Leandro Prados de la Escosura's work. We had him on last. He was saying similar things, that the health indicators and the other indicators that he looked at actually changed at times when income was stagnant. So the two, over the long run, there might be a pattern that sort of irons itself out, but in the short and medium term, it didn't seem to play a role. So as we move on to further reviewing your own extensive work on this, what historical lessons would you offer from the literature for sustainable development? You said there's no smoking gun, but are there any themes that you would say that policymakers or interventions might take account of?
Yeah, I think there were a few things that I raised in that paper. I think the first thing that that was, as I said, it's really striking that there are these differences in birth weights across space and over time. And there's a really nice paper by Diane Coffey from 2015 where she shows that the share of kind of women at risk of becoming pregnant in India who are underweight by their BMI is 42%. And if we look at similar data for the UK and for the US in the 19th century, those rates are below 10%, right? So there's really big differences in maternal underweight, in these two areas. What I take that to mean is that there's a kind of set of factors that are affecting maternal health in some low and middle income countries that didn't affect maternal health in the past in high income country, or not all high income countries, but in the kind of Western countries. What that means is that we may need more and different interventions to kind of eradicate stunting in these low and middle income countries than what we needed to eradicate it in the historical West. It also, I think, points toward the importance of gender inequality and maternal health in driving these things. So that's one potential takeaway. Another thing is that child stunting has fallen really dramatically across most countries around the world. This is a kind of fundamental part of the growth pattern. It's not a kind of, I'm not sure how many kind of people in the development world think of this as being a part of the secular increase in growth, right? That's not commonly held, but these are the same phenomenon, actually. The other thing, it relates to what we were just talking about, but you know, geography and income aren't fate. It's really interesting in this stunting project. We find that, you know, Cuba and Jamaica have extremely low rates of stunting in the kind of 1940s, which is a bit shocking because they're very poor countries. They're in a subtropical region with malaria, with lots of, you know, a difficult disease environment. And they have substantially lower stunting rates than Japan in the 1940s. And so, you know, this means that like income and geography aren't fate. There are kind of important interventions that may be relatively not that costly to implement that could potentially, you know, reduce stunting in other places. So the final kind of takeaway is catch-up growth. It's about catch-up growth. So there's a lot of evidence from history that children who experience health shocks in early life can actually experience catch-up growth later on if their environment changes. There's this kind of consensus in development that children who become stunted will remain stunted forever, right? And there's no way of helping them after that point. And that's not really what we see in history. We have, you know, the example of enslaved children in the United States who experience this really rapid catch-up growth. Work that I've done with some co-authors on World War II in Japan also shows that children who experience the kind of harsh conditions of the war in early life later experience really rapid catch-up growth. And so what I think the lesson is for kind of policymakers today is that we need to test the kind of interventions that would allow us to be able to kind of help these stunted children catch up. Because at the moment, it's almost like all of the focus is on preventing stunting. So try to prevent stunting in the first 1,000 days and then that's it. But we don't want to abandon those children that are already stunted. We should be thinking about ways that we can try to help them too.
So in a recent study, you drew on the records of a ship to gather data on telling a much larger story. It was a really interesting paper. Can you describe the data and explain the question that you were trying to answer?
Yeah, the data is remarkable. It comes from the training ship Indefatigable, difficult word to say. It was a kind of stationed in the River Mercy outside of Liverpool for the first part of its history. But the amazing thing about it is that it was very persistent over time. So it opened in the 1860s and only closed in the 1990s. And throughout that entire period, it kept very detailed records on the boys who were being trained on the ship. It was training boys for the merchant marine or the navy, kind of giving them naval or like ship skills so that they could become sailors. And so what one of the really interesting things about what they collected in the data is that they measured the boys when they entered the ship and when they left. And so you get a longitudinal measure of growth for each child, obviously at the individual level. And so then that allows you to reconstruct longitudinal growth over 120 years. This is interesting relative to what had come before for a couple of reasons. Earlier literature had really focused on comparing cross sections of children over time. And the problem with cross sectional data is that any selection on age into your sample will create problems for you. And one of the really difficult things about studying children is that most of the data comes from schools, and right in the middle of adolescence, where you expect to see a pubertal growth spurt, you often have children moving between primary school and secondary school. And so if there's positive selection into the children who end up in secondary school, it can spuriously create a pubertal growth spurt for you. And I've tried to show that there's indications that that's the case in at least some of this cross-sectional data. In the Japanese data, it's very clear because we can actually see primary school and secondary school children at the same ages, and there's a clear positive selection in them. So this individual level data is going to help deal with that and help combat that kind of thing. But the other thing that's interesting about this data is that like we had kind of individual data that covered the 19th century. We had some surveys that were in the 20th century, but this data actually covers the period of the secular increase in height, which is what we want to know about, right? That's like a big change that we want to be able to explore. And so to be able to look at that with individual level data from a consistent source was really useful. So the question I was really trying to answer here was, how did the growth pattern change over time, and what factors were affecting these changes?
Okay, so you've set me up for the question, Eric. What did you find?
Sorry, this is joint work with PayGow. We found two things. We were looking at kind of the secular increase in height. We looked at kind of children at the same age, how their height was changing over time. We found that that began in the 1880s, but the fastest growth occurred during the interwar period, which is a little bit surprising because it's not exactly a great time, you know, for living standards in the way that we would think about it, right? And that's kind of a familiar story. That kind of is similar to what people have found when looking at adult height in this way. But I think the thing that we found that was a bit shocking and surprising was that we found there was a kind of big change in the growth pattern. So for boys born before the 1910s, they didn't really experience a kind of observable pubertal growth spurt. But then after the 1910s, we kind of suddenly see a kind of high level or a high average rate of growth among children and adolescents that is more suggestive of a pubertal growth spurt. So it seems like there's a kind of change over time in the intensity of the pubertal growth spurt that we were seeing. And, you know, this could be explained by a number of things, and we go through those in the paper. But we couldn't find a kind of shock in the conditions in the ship that would explain this kind of change. It can't be related to kind of the dispersion of the timing of the pubertal growth spurt. It's not related to the distance or the length of stay of each boy on the ship. It's, you know, we do simulations and try to kind of rule out a lot of these factors. And so in the end, we find this kind of puzzling result that the pubertal growth spurt is kind of considered by human biologists to be a fundamental element of human growth, especially for boys. And yet with these boys, we don't see it, at least in the same way that we see it later. That was puzzling and interesting. Our explanation for that was that basically there were important changes from the 1910s in the kind of disease environment. And so infant mortality was falling at that point. Respiratory infections were becoming less deadly. Diarrheal mortality was falling. And so perhaps that explains this sudden change. Whereas it doesn't, like, that change comes a bit late for nutrition, because nutrition had improved a lot in the second half of the 19th century. And so it doesn't seem like it would be responsible for such a sudden break in that way.
So as you stated in that work, Eric, you're obviously dealing with ship records in the Navy for the time that it was. You're really only dealing with males. You regretted in that work that you couldn't find data on any girls for obvious reasons. But in your surveys work, the more recent work that we referred to earlier, you did collect good data on both sexes for a list of some countries. How does the female growth trajectory compare with males in the countries that you had data for?
Yeah, it was unfortunate that there were no girls on this ship. So what we see when we look at kind of a wider range of countries is that actually girls and boys tend to follow similar trends. So girls are also experiencing a decline in the age of the pubertal growth spurt. They're growing more rapidly. They are much taller than they used to be. So it's kind of similar in that sense, in the kind of, you know, if you squint and develop some stylized facts. It's a little bit difficult, though, to know exactly how our kind of finding for British boys would translate to girls. And that's because actually the pubertal growth spurt is less pronounced for girls anyway. And so it would be, you know, in some ways, the fact that we didn't find a pubertal growth spurt for boys is more surprising, because the pubertal growth spurt is very strong for boys. But for girls, maybe even 30% of them don't have a kind of identifiable pubertal growth spurt. And so it's a little bit, you know, it would be harder anyway. There are some interesting exceptions to this kind of rule where mostly things are going in the same direction. You know, we see, for instance, that mean female heights increased more than male heights in Japan and South Korea across the 20th century. So that's, I think, really interesting. And my co-author, Kota Ogasawara, has done some really interesting work that shows that girls were more strongly affected by the Kanto earthquake in Japan than boys. And his explanation for this is that it is about household allocation of resources, right? So where basically families are kind of compensating for the health shock that their sons experienced, they reinforce the health shock for girls. And that's why you see this difference in the gender effect there. But this is something I really want to look at more carefully. One of the really, really big challenges of understanding changes in kind of male and female stature over time is that the female stature and the male stature rarely come from the same source. And even when they do, like if they're both coming from a prison source, the selection into the, you know, the prison is different for women than it is for men. And so, you know, looking at comparisons over time becomes quite tricky because the selection is very, very, it's changing over time. It's difficult to manage. But one of the really cool things about the stunting project is that we have all these kind of cross-sectional studies that were done at different points in time where researchers went and tried to measure the same population. So we have the heights and sometimes the weights of comparable groups, you know, that were selected in the same way. And so we can actually look at how this kind of gender inequality in child height has changed over time or varies around the world. And so, yeah, there's ongoing work on that. So hopefully there will be something for you in the future to read about.
Now, we had Professor Richard Steckel on the show a long time ago, and he, like you, has looked at child growth under appalling conditions, namely slavery. Can you first lay down the standard story of how child growth was perceived to occur under those horrific circumstances?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, this is classic work. And, you know, I could easily have mentioned this paper as that kind of first paper that's inspired me as well. It's really important work. So what Rick found, he was studying basically the heights of enslaved children in the United States in the kind of the mid 1830s-ish, around that time period. So what he argued is that if we just kind of think about this through the developmental stages of children, so he argued that enslaved children had really low birth weights. And that was because their mothers had to do a lot of heavy labor during their pregnancy, and especially the kind of upright position that they were in kind of prevented blood flow to the placenta and led to a really low birth weight. He also mentions malaria and sickle cell anemia as being other factors that would reduce birth weights. And then, like, just, you know, after birth, they experienced really horrific conditions. They're given really poor food. They actually, enslaved children are not given their own rations until much later in life. The sanitary conditions around slave dwellings were really, really poor. And it was also really difficult for enslaved women to breastfeed because their owners were forcing them to work, basically, or they only got to return from the fields maybe twice a day to breastfeed their children. So this kind of, the conditions in early life were really, really bad for enslaved children. And where we've actually taken Rick's data and computed a stunting rate, and we find that the stunting rate of enslaved children is 71%. So again, like Japan 1900, India in the 1990s, it's really atrocious, this health. So they're kind of starting from a very, very poor health standard. But what Rick found is that after the age of 10, enslaved children started to experience catch-up growth. And the catch-up growth that they experienced is, like, in terms of magnitude, the largest catch-up growth that has ever been observed in any population. And he argued this was because once children started working in the plantation, the slave owners had an incentive to invest in them and to give them food. And so therefore, they started getting a proper diet, and this allowed them to experience this catch-up growth. This paper is really influential. So people have been arguing with it for many years, but there's a kind of another reading where by Coelho and McGuire, where they argue that getting shoes was also really important because hookworm is a kind of intestinal parasite that saps children's kind of energy and resources. And it enters through your feet, right? And so if you get shoes, then it actually protects you against hookworm and would reduce the hookworm burden in your body and allow you to grow as well. So the interesting thing is that then by adulthood, enslaved people were much, much taller than we would have expected them to be if we'd just been looking at them as children. And interestingly, from a comparative perspective, historically, they were actually taller than European working class people. Okay, taller than British working class, Irish working class, Dutch working class people. And so obviously they were still short relative to modern standards. And no, like, I'm not in any way arguing that they were healthy or that they're, that this was a good thing for anyone. It was horrific. So, you know, slavery is horrific in all of its aspects. But, you know, an irony of it was that actually enslaved people were relatively well fed because their owners wanted them to work really hard and they needed to feed them in order for them to be able to work.
We've talked about Rick's work, but what motivated you to revisit the question and what did you do differently to the standard?
So as I was saying earlier, in my master's, I spent quite a bit of time learning about the biology of human growth. And as is the case, the kind of scientific literature had moved forward, you know, since 1986. It's not surprising anyone, right? So I wrote two papers in my master's. One in the first year, I wrote one on about the biology of human growth. And in the second year, I wrote a paper about the health of enslaved people in the Americas. And at kind of the end of my PhD, I was trying to kind of put together an introduction, right? And I went back and revisited these two papers I'd written earlier in my time at Oxford. And I realized that actually you could juxtapose the two things together. And so the paper is really, I think the key contribution here is that it's to analyze the growth pattern of slaves in light of the kind of new evolutionary theories of human development that had been developed since 1986 when Rick published that paper. And so actually, it's a funny paper in a way because literally there is no new evidence. I did not collect any new data. There's literally nothing new about it except the interpretation of the existing research that had been done before.
So how did your findings compare with the existing studies and what were the underlying reasons for any differences with the existing work that you mentioned?
I think the biggest difference between Rick and I on this topic is thinking about birth weights of enslaved people. So as I said earlier, Rick argued that enslaved children had really, really low birth weights. And he argued that they were about 2,300 grams. By the way, birth weights are completely unobservable. We have no data for this at all. And so Rick had kind of used the data that was available at the time to try to impute a birth weight from the children's heights at ages 3 or 4. But this kind of 2,300 gram birth weight seemed really implausibly low to me for a number of reasons. But one is that when Dora Costa was able to observe the birth weights of Black children in Baltimore in the early 20th century, she found that their birth weight was nearly 3,200 grams, right? So if that were the case, then there would have been like a 900 gram increase in Black children's birth weights in 60 years, which is completely outside of anything that we have ever observed or, you know, seen in any way. And so what I tried to do was actually think, well, okay, if we just take that away for a second, what story makes more sense, right? That enslaved children experience these very, very poor birth weights, or does it make more sense that what we're seeing here is a pattern of growth faltering? So enslaved children actually had birth weights that were closer to the modern norm, not at the modern norm, but maybe a bit below, because we see that there are gaps, racial gaps today in birth weight. Black children have lower birth weights than white children in the United States. So not at the norm, but, you know, a bit below the norm. And then these terrible conditions, really, truly appalling conditions in early childhood would have led to this huge growth faltering, right, that may have occurred in the first couple of years of their lives before we can kind of really observe their heights in a meaningful way. That's kind of the argument that I made, that this fit then within these kind of evolutionary theories of development about how shocks at different points at different developmental stages would affect the growth pattern and kind of fit more widely into what we're seeing there. I also kind of argue, this is a more minor point, that the catch of growth actually begins a bit earlier than what Rick originally kind of argued. And if you kind of measure the growth in terms of Z-scores rather than percentiles, you see that there's actually some catch-up growth that occurs before the age of 10. And there's some reason to explain that earlier catch-up. As I kind of hinted, enslaved children often didn't get their own rations until they were 2. And so in the first 2 years of life, their parents were having to feed them from their own rations that they were given. And so that, you know, is a recipe for everybody to be, you know, undernourished. And so maybe this kind of, when they get their own rations, then that allows these children to start experiencing a bit of catch-up growth a bit earlier. That's just one potential explanation. So I think like the real contribution of the paper isn't to kind of nitpick Rick's data. Like that wasn't really my goal in any way. It was more to show how we could use these evolutionary theories of child development to kind of understand changes in the growth pattern, and also to explain this kind of really peculiar, as he called it, growth pattern of enslaved children in the U.S. South.
Professor Eric Schneider, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I hope we hear from you in the future and look forward to reading your forthcoming work.
Thanks very much for having me, Sean.